All right, here we go. It's the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. I know Chef Terry does too. I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including Serious Pie downtown, which is open for to-go. Seatown Restaurant down on the north end of the Pike Place Market, which is open for outdoor dining with heated chairs or heated overheads or something.
heated chairs, be careful.
Delicious fish and chips and chicken pot pies and things like that. And, of course, Hot Stove Society here, where we do our show, is open and virtual and ready for business online. And then I hope to see you out at the warehouse, our serious takeout out at the Ballard Warehouse, which is 52nd and 14th Avenue Northwest. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. You can get us here live, or you can get us on a podcast. But I am joined by my friend and pal, Chef Terry Rotureau.
The chef in the hat,
chef in the hat.
And we have Luke in Madison Valley still making boxes and making to-go food.
Lovely.
Obviously, no indoor dining, but we look forward to seeing you at... Just go to luketogo.com and shop around and... We'll gladly put it in a bag for you, in a box.
We're going to have a full 2 hours of COVID-free fun. Well, you get COVID every place else. No, I don't mean it like that. You get COVID information every place else, but we talk about food.
That's right.
And wine and beer and deliciousness.
And dreams.
Today on the show, we're going to discuss the art of the French dip. Happens to be my wife Jackie's favorite sandwich. What's just the right bread? How do you make the jus? Do you like it? Is there such a thing as a rare French dip, or is all French dip well done? So there's that question to be answered later in the show. Our friend Jamie Piha is here from the Auction of Washington Wines to tell us about their bid for Bottles Holiday Edition fundraiser for Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. Just because it's tough out there doesn't mean we can't. We still have to support all these places that need our help. We'll return to one of our favorite segments, Cities We Miss, and head south to see our neighbors in Portland, virtually in our heads, Chef Terry and I. Love Portland. There's so many cool things going on there. With the holidays approaching, there's been some new appetizer dip recipes. I was just making crab dip for our Thanksgiving box a couple of days ago. My mom's crab dip, which had such a familiar taste to it. I loved it. And, of course, we're going to have some Black Friday sale deals to talk about. We don't have Food for Thought Tasty Trivia today. Madeline's off today, so we had to kind of forego that segment. But we have some interesting things to kind of chat about.
I'm sure we'll still trivia something.
Chef Terry, this is traditionally a time when we go to, what was your favorite bite of the week?
What was your favorite, Tom?
My favorite? I had a couple. And one of the ones that I really liked that I think that people can do at home so easily, but they don't think about it, or I'm not sure why they don't more, but... Instead of just making mashed potatoes for my dinner last Thanksgiving, I did 33% celery root, 33% parsnip, and 33%
potatoes.
And we had a couple of varieties from the farm, and we're just using up the final farm potatoes from our farm over in Prosser. And I as I was tasting it, because I don't like it. You like a real puree, traditionally. You
Correct.
Like a fine puree. I'm more of a chunky guy.
You're a mashed potato. I'm a puree potato.
Yeah, and I'm even less than mash. I'm kind of I like a rough, a little bit of a rough.
Crush.
I like a little tooth. I'm more of a crush. I think that's a good way to put it. And so I kept having the tastes for seasoning and all that kind of stuff. It is so unctuous. Parsnips and root, celery root compared to potato are so... unctuous and delicious.
Well, they've got a lot of flavor, too.
They have a ton of flavor. And so it just made this mash just something extraordinary.
Right.
And I think that people are a little scared of parsnips. They don't quite know what to do with them. My trick is that I take whatever I'm adding to my mashed potato, and I know that parsnips are a little tough.
Right.
They take a little more time to cook than a potato does, even. But I do cut them all about the same size. And then I've got my... pot, and I start my parsnips first. Celery root goes pretty fast.
Right.
Then I put my potatoes in, then I put my celery root in, so that they're all about done at the same time. I might give the parsnips 5 minute head start.
Right.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, 5 minutes.
5 minutes,
good.
Plenty. Celery root, a minute. Or even potatoes.
Even though parsnip is tougher, it's also much smaller. So if you cut your celery, your parsnip a little bit smaller, you have the timing will be even.
Yeah, it'll be no problem.
Right.
So My suggestion is you continue through this holiday season and you start to think about, you know, special holiday dinners. Try a root vegetable mash. And I wouldn't even bother with things like rutabaga. It doesn't have enough flavor.
Correct.
But I would, these kind of aromatic ones like celery root and parsnips, I would add to my mashed potatoes.
That's a
I loved it.
I love celery root. I'm a big fan of celery root raw, cooked. I mean, I think it is a gorgeous vegetable.
I don't think people...
I think that when you say people are scared of parsnip, I think they're more scared of celery root.
Oh, for sure.
I see people walk by and looking at it like it's something from a foreign planet or something. I mean, it's because it's kind of, if you've never seen it and you never used it, it is definitely one of those things you walk by and you go, maybe next time.
Yeah. Well, it's intimidating, the big knobby end. And, but it does shred beautifully raw, too.
Oh, yeah, makes such a beautiful salad appetizer. I think it's gorgeous. For me, it's... Brussels sprout again. I discovered what we did, what, 40 pounds of Brussels sprout for Thanksgiving boxes during the week. And deglaze with Madeira. So saute them in brown butter first to give it that nice little crunchiness on the outside. So don't be afraid. Get your pan hot. Put your butter in there. Wait till it gets dark brown. And then put in your celery, your Brussels sprouts cut in quarters, and then toss them around till they have a nice color. And then throw in some mushroom in there, throw in some quartered button mushroom, and then toss that around as well in the brown butter. Then deglaze with Madeira. Don't be shy. Madeira is not that expensive. It's a good little wine. Gives nice flavor. Deglaze with Madeira. Let it cook gently like this on the fire, medium heat. Let it finish to cook, and then drop in a good nugget of butter in there.
A second nugget, because you started with brown butter.
Well, you know, butter is never enough in the, in the dish.
All right, it's a
buttery Brussels sprout, yes. But with the mushroom and the Brussels sprout and the Madeira flavor, man, it changes to drastically what the what you, you know, I mean, very commonly you see Brussels sprout. They taste like crunchy Brussels sprout.
All right, give me one alternative to Madeira, because a lot of people don't have it, and they don't want to buy a whole jar. So if you have a little bit of sherry,
white wine,
a little bit of what about brandy?
Well, go gently on the brandy because it's really brandy is pretty strong.
It might burn your eyebrows off too.
Yeah, just back off when you do that. But brandy is not a bad idea, but it's a bit sharper than Madeira. I'm looking for something a little bit sweeter kind of idea.
Marsala
would be delicious.
Yeah, good. If you want to go play with Madeira and make a couple of things over the next month with Madeira, then buy a bottle.
And
it's not expensive.
And by the way, the juice that's left in the pan, if you have some left. If you haven't cooked too high of a heat, that's a great way to finish that and put a, like I said, you put a nugget of butter and you can put that over your leftover turkey sliced breast or whatever you have left over from Thanksgiving.
Chef, did you say put Brussels sprout juice over your turkey?
Yes.
Okay. You French guys, you're a little weird.
Don't waste it. Why?
Up next, it's time to discuss the art of the French dip sandwich right here in the Hot Stove Society radio show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Hot Stove Society Radio, right here from the Hot Stove Society Virtual Kitchen, downtown Seattle. Chef, I've got a French dip sandwich pop up, and I wanted to know if it's cultural appropriation if I, Tom Douglas, of Scottish, Irish, German, Swedish descent, am allowed to make a French dip sandwich.
You know, I'm not sure that French dip is from France.
It's not. I was trying to catch you in a trap.
I know the name, and I've had it many times. I don't think it's French.
Yeah, no, it's from L.A.
Yeah.
Yeah, funny how that goes. There's a couple of places down there, Coles and Philippe's, that both think they started it, but it sounds like it started in the early teens or 30s or something.
Yeah, I think as far back, as the 30s,
So do you like a French dip? I know it's
not. I like a French. You know, I have another true... A French dip where I can go, I want to eat this every week.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I've had one of those, so I'm very curious to try yours when you make it on the dock.
Well, yeah, and I think that, like, everything that I do, like, for example, when I had my cheesesteak pop-up last week, I didn't make it. Like, I'm not trying to imitate what they do in Philly. I don't love a Philly cheesesteak, especially I hate it with Whiz.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I was growing up on cheesesteaks, Whiz wasn't the big deal that it is now, and to me it's a cop-out. you know, I like real sharp provolone on my cheesesteak, the way it started years ago. It's a kind of an American-Italian sandwich and blah, blah, blah. So I would approach French dip in the same way. And so when I do make these sort of things, like when I made my chili dog on the dock, I made like guajillo ground beef chili for my chili dog. I didn't just get something out of a can and put it on. Right. So I like taking classics like that and kind of giving them my own chefy twist to them without taking them out of the world from which they came.
Cool.
It's still a chili dog, right?
Right.
It's still a cheesesteak.
It still looks like one, tastes like one.
Yeah, exactly.
But it just tastes a little bit higher.
Well, not necessarily. Not to some people.
Yeah,
some people
like
that flavor profile of the kind of the crappy chili dog. And you know, they don't want me to dress it up. And I get that. Totally, I do. You know, I love a good Oreo or a good barbecue potato chips just like anybody else. But when it comes to French dip, my wife is an expert. She knows what she likes, and that's all there is to it, Jackie. But what I would say is let's start with the roll.
Well, first, the three highlight components, the bread, the beef, and the jus.
And the jus, okay.
Right? So those are the main components. I mean, I've never had a French dip where they added all kind of relish or anything like this. Never had one of those like that.
There is no relish, as far as I'm concerned. To me, even if you add browned onions, which I'm going to add to mine, you're taking it out of the traditional French dip realm, generally. If you add cheese, you're out of the French dip realm. I'm not going to add cheese to mine, but I am going to add brown onions. I have found little things in life don't benefit from browned onions.
Correct. Very few
you
things.
You can put them on me and I would taste better.
Just so you know, I've put caramelized onion in a jar, canned, and I sell it on my site, and people buy it.
They're so good.
They go with anything. You're right. There is no place where it doesn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like, I mean, I can't really think, except maybe for dessert, but...
Okay, so I'm going to start with bread, and I'm going to, for me, I would like a little bit more traditional French baguette, not the country baguette, but a more traditional, lighter style baguette, which I am going to put butter on and toast the outside of the bun, so that I get a little crispy, buttery crunch. Because what I want is a crackle, kind of like a lobster roll bun. Where when I make a lobster roll, I like to toast the top of the bun in butter and salt, so that when you bite into that kind of mushy lobster center, that you get a little crunch.
Right.
So same thing I'm going to do with the baguette is that I'm going to put butter on the outside and then toast and crisp it up with salt the bun. Now the meat, really excited about the meat because. I found a couple of different options, but I found prime top sirloin cap off. So literally it's
prime top, so it's just meat.
It's just meat, 100%.
Right.
And so I don't have any waste, and it's going to make it simple for me to roast. And then after I roast it, I put it in the freezer for an hour or two.
Chill it down,
but I need it ice cold to slice.
Right.
Because I want it sliced really thin. I need it cold.
Right.
And it's really difficult to slice warm, kind of rare beef.
Well, on a slicer, yes, it's impossible.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. So my trick is to go ahead and cut it into slicer-sized chunks, put it in the freezer, and then slice it when it's about three-quarters frozen.
Right.
And then I make my little... At this point, you have to make kind of like your little portion packs.
Correct.
For me.
Yeah.
I'm going to do 150 sandwiches on the dock. I need a portion pack.
Yeah, you have to do it.
Okay. So I've got this beautiful meat. I've got it seasoned with my roast rub in my Rub With Love line. It's sliced thin. So now I'm looking at, I've got maybe a 6 or 8 inch baguette chunk. I've got about 6 ounces of rare beef that's been cooked with seasoning.
So rare.
Rare beef.
Okay.
That's been cooked with seasoning. And now I got the jus. How would you make your jus?
Well, I would use beef scraps to start roasting those in the pan.
Okay.
Adding some onions. I would toss the whole thing, fresh herbs, bay leaf, thyme, peppercorn. I would do a classic startup. Then I would do a little bit of red wine, not too much, just a little bit of red wine, deglaze the pan. And then I would use veal stock or beef stock. And then
chicken stock? Would you be comfortable with chicken stock
Chicken stock would work because you have the beef scraps. So.
Yeah.
All you're doing is...
Because you want a light jus, right?
Yeah,
you're not
looking
for like a demi-glace.
No. You're looking for a jus, but you want flavor in that jus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had jus that were like fresh out of the faucet.
Right.
It's kind of like no interest whatsoever in that. So if your jus is too light, just add some spices to it, add some herbs, and then reduce it down slowly, and you'll enhance the flavor. I mean, whatever's in there.
You reduce it down, but for a traditional French dip sandwich, I would say you need about 4 ounces of jus. So it takes a lot. That's a lot. So
especially if you do 150 of them.
Right. So you do have to be careful. That's why I say chicken stock, because in my world, I have to worry about the price point.
No,
I can't just take 100 pounds of beef bones.
Oh, no.
Because beef bones are $2-3 a pound, they have to be roasted.
$3 a pound.
It's just it's unaffordable. My sandwich would be $25.
Right.
So now I've got that. So for me, now I'm going to finish up. I've got my butter toasted bun. I've got my rare beef. I've got my jus. Now I have to serve it.
Right.
Okay, so I take my rare beef, and I have a little strainer, and I put the strainer right, I kind of wave it through the hot jus. So a little bit like shabu-shabu in Japanese cooking.
I was going to say, you learned that from an Asian restaurant.
Well, shabu-shabu is you dip that meat right in the hot broth.
Yeah.
So your broth continues to get better. The last sandwich of the day is probably the best jus of the day.
I'd be there at 6 p.m.
Yeah, exactly. And you just take that rare beef, and it doesn't need to stay rare, but I like to start it rare.
Right.
And then you just kind of dredge it through the hot broth, pop it on your sandwich, add your browned onions. If you want to gild the lily, fresh horseradish grated right over top of that for me would be great. I like a little shallot mustard on my bun. And then
you're not changing the whole thing.
Now I have a French dip sandwich.
A good sandwich.
I'm not changing a lot. I'm adding some different flavor profiles.
Right, right.
Because oftentimes I find them on crappy buns, bad beef, and canned jus.
Yeah.
And that's why it's okay. I'm gonna make a little effort.
It is different.
But I'm not drastically changing the concept of the sandwich. I'm just trying to use a little bit better technique.
Right. No, it's good. Very, very, very good. Because it's the good thing is you didn't change the price too much.
Yeah, the price is $15. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's good. That's a good price for a good sandwich like this. And 6 ounces of meat is a lot.
It's a lot. I'll be doing that French dip if you want to come by on December the 2nd. From 12 to 7 p.m.
Next Wednesday.
Yeah.
Cool.
12 to 7 p.m. I'm looking for you around 6:55.
Yeah, I'm getting that jus reduced.
Although I'll tell you that my cheesesteak pop-up sold out. The people that came last didn't get cheesesteaks.
Mm.
I'm just telling you that right now, okay. Mister, I'm going to be last one in for the best jus. On the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo. Tom Douglas here.
Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
Chef, let's take a trip. When was the last time you traveled? Although you have traveled a little bit more than I have, I think.
I traveled about a month and a half ago.
Month and a half ago.
For my brother-in-law's wedding in Arkansas.
Oh, in Arkansas.
Next to Texarkana. And it was a culinary wake-up call.
A culinary wasteland.
That too.
A food desert.
You're not going to believe this. We were there for 3 days. We went for breakfast 3 days in a row to a place called Cracker Barrel.
Uh-huh.
That was the...
You're right. I don't believe that. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, that is. But you know what? It's a huge menu, like four-page kind of menu.
I know, chef. It's a 1,000-unit restaurant chain.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you one thing. They don't have a green vegetable on that menu.
All right. Well, let's travel, you and I, virtually to Portland in our heads and kind of remember some of our delicious meals that we've had down there at great restaurants that we've enjoyed going to for years and years. And then Sean's got a couple ideas on some new places to visit. Sean is producing today instead of Madeline. So, Sean, we'll come to you towards the end to find out what's the hot new spot that we should check out when we get a chance to go to Portland again. So, Chef, favorite restaurants?
Well, I'm going to start with something, a bakery first.
Okay.
Because I like Saint Honoré's Bakery. Have you been to? I'm sure you have been to. No?
Not that I remember.
Oh.
I've been to Bunk Sandwiches.
Yes. No, Saint Honoré's Bakery, I think it's a great place to go for either a little French sandwich or a nice croissant. They have some beautiful pastries in that place. And
so a French sandwich is what? Pâté en baguette? What is a French sandwich?
Yeah, it could be cheese and cheese, butter, and baguette.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be ham and cheese and baguette, cornichon and, you know, stuff garnished like that. That's what I call a traditional French sandwich.
Okay.
And then other than that, all the, you know, they have quiches, they have croissant, almond croissant, all kinds of different things with puff pastry. And they make a, they do a very good job at it, and they do a bang business. Mm-hmm. They also make one thing that is delicious and I always bring back, which is their country roll bread. They have a big, like a 14-inch or two, at least 14-inch pie kind of looking bread-like, you know, those big bull. Oh, man, that bread is so delicious. Very rye-like, country-like, but really delicious.
But not sour.
No, no, sour.
Sour, okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm a big sour bread. I like my sourdough bread. So anyway, Honoré's Bakery is on, Saint Honoré's Bakery is on 2335 Northwest Thurman Street. And I recommend it for, you know, there's always a line, so be ready to wait in line. But I don't know what it's like today because I haven't been there in a, obviously since COVID. So, but I recommend it as a little start of the day. Nice cup of coffee and a croissant there. And on the way out, buy your nice loaf of bread, bring it back to the city.
I thought for sure you were going to say Le Pigeon because it's
well, Le Pigeon is
it's right up. I know. So I'm trying to say it's kind of in my mind, right up your alley a little bit.
Oh, definitely, I will go to Le Pigeon
because that opened maybe what 15 years ago, maybe
yeah,
longer.
Maybe
huh?
Not even. Yeah, 15.
He's got a few restaurants now,
right?
And that's kind of the place that I kind of epitomize Portland restaurants being. A little bit in an old building, open kitchen, you know.
Nice ambiance. The
nice
ambiance. Feel-good kind of restaurant.
Right. And
and sitting at the bar, I sat at the bar before, and I've, you know, it's fantastic.
And I love, I'll never forget this time, I can't remember the owner's name, but he's one of James Beard Award stuff. I would say, God, this pea, sweet pea risotto is so good. Where are you getting your peas? He said, the freezer. So, yeah. I often thought of John Gorham's restaurants down there. I don't know if he's still involved in his, but Toro Bravo is one of my favorite cookbooks and was one of my favorite Portland restaurants. He's also got Tasty and Son or Tasty and...
Tasty something.
Tasty and Alder or something like that. I've always enjoyed his restaurants. He and his wife both own those, I believe.
What is that area called? The area off
well,
of
Tasty and Alder is right in downtown, I believe, and then northeast Portland is where Toro Bravo is, and places like that.
No, it's a good, definitely two good restaurants. You know, always at the Heathman, there is. I've done many dinner at the Heathman with the chef down there for over the year, and that's always a great spot when you're downtown. For those people who like hats, there is a hat store right across the street. That's pretty cool.
Another one place that I've been to that I thought was super fun was called Bollywood Theater.
I've heard of it, but I've never been. Is it really good?
It's absolutely really good. And what I think is really fun about it is that so often when you go to Indian restaurants, they're steeped in kind of traditional North Indian heavy cooking, I would say,
right.
And this place is bright and cheery and lovely and fun, so I can't wait to go back there. I did mention Bunk Sandwiches. That was a Portland institution, several locations, I believe. I don't know what's there now, but looking forward to going back and checking out.
How about Pelly's Place? It's been there for a long
time. That's in Northwest.
That's in Northwest, yeah. But it's really delicious. I mean, again, you go into a house. To me, that's Portland, too. Even on a, it's a bit fancier dining, but it's still in a house. It's beautiful. It's, the ambiance is simple, you know, very comfortable. And the food is delicious. I mean, Vitaly is a great chef and does all kind of beautiful Italian food there. And I think it's a classic. If you've never been, you definitely owe at least one visit there.
Oh, the Pine State Biscuits. That's one of my favorite places to go for breakfast. They have hash browns and biscuits are kind of the basis of their menu. And certainly that was an inspiration for us to get into Serious Biscuit just because of how lovely it is to just focus on one item.
You know, were already open when you opened yours?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were open for years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very inspirational place, I thought, from a restaurateur's perspective because sometimes I think us restaurateurs, we get lost in trying to be all things to all people.
Right.
And I really like where dining has gone over the last 10, 15 years. And I would say Serious Pie is a good example also. So focus in an area, try to keep it simple, And, you know, I only have 7 pizzas on the Serious Pie menu. Right. I have a couple of apps, a couple of salads, straight ahead. Right. You know, and it is what it is, and that's what you go there for. Right. It's right. A little bit like, you know, if you want to extrapolate, it's like a McDonald's menu. It's like right. It's burgers, right? Or Dick's is the classic example, Dick's right. Drive-ins.
I mean, I think it's when it's focused like this, it's very easy for the guest and for the customer to come in and know exactly what they're coming for. And they keep coming back because when they think about one item, they think about you.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, if they think of pizza, they're not going to think of me. Even if I had one on the menu, they wouldn't think of me.
Mm-hmm.
But when they think of pizza, they're going to think of you because you have 7 great pizza on the menu.
It's focused. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
I think it's a good point.
Did you ever, when you were in Portland, did you ever get to Kachka?
Nope.
Kind of Russian, Middle
no,
East,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Russian, not Middle
you've
East,
talked about
Eastern
this.
European.
Yeah, you've talked about it. I haven't had a chance to get there. Sounds like a great place for brunch.
It's good for everything, especially if you're ready to drink some vodka. They have a vodka tasting menu and lots of caviar and lots of beets. You know, you love beets,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Fun place. I would definitely go there in a second.
How about on the way out? Often leaving for lunch during the day. Stop at Pock Pock and, you know, get some food to go as well on the way out. So by the time I get to Seattle, I have a little dinner.
You know, it's funny. I had heard that Pock Pock is closed.
What?
That's what I had heard. But maybe I'm mistaken. But that's kind of what I heard. So.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I haven't heard that. But, well, I hope not for them. I doubt it, though. They're busy.
Oh, I understand, but you know, you still have to. You have to run it. You have to
be there
and run the
show.
And then I was just looking up Han Oak. I didn't remember how to spell Han. H-A-N-O-A-K. Han Oak. I think, in my mind, one of the best dumpling restaurants I've ever been to, and it is. It's Korean dumplings. It is delicious. Where is it?
Yeah,
I don't remember where it is.
It's in Portland. And
oh, yeah, it's in Portland. But it's Northeast 24th Avenue. What I loved about this place was that it's super tiny, and when he first opened, everyone was on it, right? It was like such a Portland classic.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go there. And the place was just jammed every day, every meal service. And he had to start making dumplings in a truck because he didn't have any more space in his kitchen. It was just so crazed. And it's super awesome. And I really like the food there. And I would make a trip just to Portland. Just to Han Oak in Portland just to eat there. And I'd turn around
cool.
and come back home. If I only had one place to go, that would be one of the places I would take. Anyway, Sean, did you have a place that, as a newbie, you don't travel to Portland as much as we do?
I have not been to Portland, since this whole kind of past mm-hmm. year. But looking at some of the stuff, it looks like they're, you know, continuing to come up with a lot of interesting eateries that have adapted to the changes. I'm seeing a lot of outdoor dining and burger carts. We've got Rough Draft Burger, which is kind of a smash burger, you know, just a little griddle patty.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Farmer and the Beast, which is sort of a little bit bigger of a large kind of hearty burger. But it sounds like they have a really cool concept for a food cart. They've got sort of farm-to-table sort of style worked into some of their dishes. We've got a couple outdoor places that sound really cool. Cooperativa is a minimalist outside Italian market that has all types of vegetables and sort of cured meats, Italian meats, and things like that.
Sounds fabulous.
Sounds like a fun one.
I can't wait to go.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
That's
yeah,
the problem totally. With these segments when we talk about New York last week or Portland this week. It's just like, okay, it's bad enough that you can't go, and now we're just torturing ourselves.
Yeah, really.
Memories. Thank God we got some.
Up next, Jamie Piha is here with an auction for Washington Wine benefiting Seattle Children's Hospital. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. All right, we've invited Jamie Piha to come on the show. Jamie is the executive director at the Auction of Washington Wines, and it's time for an auction to help benefit Children's Hospital. And so, Jamie, welcome to the Hot Stove Society Radio Show.
Hello, Jamie.
Whoa. Hey, hello, and happy post-Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super fun. What's going on at the Auction of Washington Wines these days? This is the holiday version, right?
This is the holiday version. It's really, it's brand new and it's super fun. I mean, I'm loving it. I'm bidding like crazy, which is, I don't need any more wine, but you know, there's so many great lots. It's been really, really fun. So it's called Bid for Bottles Holiday Edition. And we have, it's all online. We have more than 100 wineries who stepped up to participate in this holiday auction. So it really is a wonderful cross-section of the wine industry across the state. So it's very exciting. And people can find it at auctionofwawines.org. It's free to register, so you can even register and just take a look at what's there. And it's, and I know that you'll find something that you will love. There's about 120 lots. They're all bottles, so there's no packages or things like that, but it's just wines that start at, like, let's say $50 and go up to $2,500 packages. And that's really the highest package. But there's some really great wines in there. And, you know, we're kind of calling it, you know, give a gift, keep a gift. We won't tell. Because you want, when sometimes when you buy wine, you think, I'm going to give this as a gift. And then it ends up in your cellar. Right. You know, that's just the way wine is, right?
Yep. Are there some large format or some interesting kind of auction lots?
There are. And a couple from some good friends of yours, actually. We found in our Auction of Washington Wine Cellar a 2008 Chinook Wines Cabernet Sauvignon from Yakima Valley. Mm-hmm. It's a 1.5 liter, and it's just an incredible Cabernet. It was originally featured at the 20th annual Washington Wine Festival, which eventually kind of merged with the auction. And it's a beautiful etched bottle and just one of a kind. Like, you can't get this wine anywhere. And so it's wonderful. And it's also great to buy some of these older vintage wines, so you get a feeling of the strength and the ageability of Washington wine across time. It's just, you know, there's just some great finds.
Yeah, I think it is something that people are often not considering, but there are, when you have the opportunity to drink all the Washington wine, you should definitely do it, because you discover that the wines are actually very different when they're 20 years old, 25 years old. Mm-hmm. I just had a 91 Leonetti Merlot
wow,
a couple of nights ago, and that was scrumptious. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really beautiful. It was perfect. You know, it wasn't perfect in 93, as far as I'm concerned,
right,
but it is definitely beautiful now.
Yeah.
So those kind of gems, you know, it's like aging wine. To, it's one of my favorite things in the world is to drink wine that are 20 plus years old. I love that. You know, sometimes the wine doesn't hold, and that's just the gamble you're taking.
But. Right, right. Well, we're finding that Washington wine has a tremendous amount of structure, so they are holding for a long time. I mean, I've got a couple that are 25 years old, and I've opened them up, and, you know, and they're good. I mean, but it's fun to try.
Yeah.
So one of the categories in this auction is called Then and Now. And so we asked wineries to submit a package of just two bottles of the same wine, but over time. So, like, you'll find a Woodward Canyon in there from, like, 1998 with a current release of 2018 of the same wine.
That's very clever.
So, right?
I think that's what everybody should do. They should try the wine now, and they should try it 20 years later, see what that looks like.
Right.
Because that's
right.
How you
and
build,
to be able to try them
cereal.
Side by side.
Yeah, but in reality, you have to take good notes, because you're not going to remember in 20 years.
No.
That's a lot of wine to go. That's why it really is important to keep a nice little logbook of your good old bottles that you've tried and take a couple of notes. You don't have to get wine snobby crazy,
but it's fun
to take notes.
Right.
Jamie, I really like these auctions for kind of larding my library of wines. Because, you know, when you drink, like you just said, you drink a 98 or 96.
Yeah.
It's not likely that you have many of those on the shelf, right? So that if you find that wine that you love, that 99 Woodward Canyon I just had a Leonetti 99, and a Quill Cedar Creek. But if you find that wine and you take a note, when you see that same wine at auction, you know, cool, I want another bottle of that. That's how I felt about the 1967s out of out of Italy, you know, in the Piemonte area. And I had a couple of mags of 67s and 71s, and frankly, 71 was rated higher, but the 67s were drinking better and lovely.
Wow.
And so when I look at Italian wine auctions, I look for that particular vintage. And I always try to buy in large format because they age better.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. You know, that's really great. You know, Tom and Terry, it sounds like you need to register for this auction right away.
Did somebody tell you we were in COVID mode?
I will tell you this. There's a couple of really amazing things that we pulled out of our cellar. And one is a 10-year vertical of Quilts Need a Creek. Mm-hmm. It's 1989 to 1997.
So is that 10 years?
That's not 10 years.
Yes, yes it is. 89, 1991, and 2005. It's 9 years. I'm sorry. It's 9 years. I can't count. Too much wine.
Yeah, that's probably the $2,500 lot, right?
I'm not telling. You have
You're
to
not
go
telling.
Look.
Okay, you have to go look.
But well, here's a couple other really special things. I'm just going to squeeze this in here so that you guys know, because I know you'll be shopping as soon as the radio show is over. We have wines from different regions. So we have, like, you can buy 6 bottles of wine from Red Mountain, but from different labels. Walla Walla. You can buy across a vertical. So you could do 5 different wineries, a Cabernet from each. And then we have some private barrel auction wines, which you can't find these wines anywhere on any shelf. So these are amazing wines that were made one time only for the private barrel auction. Those are like my favorite wines that are on there right now. And then we do have some case wines available too. And they're from, because we couldn't have picnic this year, live event, obviously everything's online. We had 30 wineries lined up to do the barrel auction, which is super fun. And so what we did was we asked 5 of those wineries to participate with the wines they were going to share and showcase there. So you've got some case wines. And then we have some grower lots because, you know, the growers are, I mean, a huge part of this industry. You can't have wine without the growers.
That's right.
So you can do it across a grower portfolio, like Boucher or like Sagemore. And so these are lots you just wouldn't normally go out and buy. So it's fun to take a look.
And all the money raised is going to Seattle Children's Hospital?
There's 2 beneficiaries. And, you know, the auction has raised $52 million over the years, which is a lot for Seattle Children's. They've been our partner since 1987. And then we also support and give back to the wine industry through really important research that, you know, frankly, will secure the future of the industry because the cutting-edge research is helping to teach people coming into the industry about how to manage vineyards and wine in Washington State. So money also goes there through WSU Wine Science Research.
Fun.
Beautiful.
All right. So the website is www.auctionofwashingtonwines.org to learn more.
No, Washington. It's just WA. Auctionofwawines.org.
Okay. Auctionofwawines.org. And you can learn more. Up next, it's time to talk about crudités and dips and things like that you might want to set yourself up with for the rest of the holiday season on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome to hour number 2 of the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat. And yes, thank you for staying with us.
Yes, exactly. We have so much more to do. And I will mention to our Facebook, traditional Facebook watchers, normally, the Facebookers live watch on Wednesday mornings when we tape our show, but we had some technical difficulties last Wednesday. We apologize if you tuned in and we weren't there. We are going to be moving to Friday mornings from 9 to 11, though, in the future, just so you know that. If you ever want to watch us do our show live, you're welcome to join us on Facebook Live on Fridays from 9 to 11. So
Sign up and watch us.
In this hour, we're going to welcome Danielle Alvarez and her new cookbook, Always Add Lemon. And we're going to try and make this work. We're going to see. But Danielle is, Sean, 18 hours ahead of us in Australia. So she already knows what our weather looks like coming tomorrow. maybe so, Southern Hemisphere. It's summer down there. We're very jealous. We have collected all your questions for the meat counter. So we're going to answer those so that when you go up to the meat counter, whether you're at Don and Joe's here in the Pike Place Market, or you're at the meat counter at Metropolitan Market, or you're at the meat counter at Costco, wherever you shop for your meat, there's some good questions to ask about the product itself and how to get what you want and how to get probably the best value, too. We have some Black Friday deals in our own companies. We're going to talk about at the end of the show because for the first time in my recollection, Food for Thought Tasty Trivia is taking a hiatus for 1 week. Again, technical difficulties. Madeline couldn't be here today, so we are going to chat about other stuff. But let's first start on some simple, easy dips. Let's just say you've got a small group coming to your house because of...
Very small.
Well, 2, 4, 6, somewhere in that neighborhood. And you're keeping things simple. And what is your favorite type of crudité and dip? And I don't know that...
Well, I'm a big
fan. Do you live in this world?
Not too much, but I do live in that world from time to time. It does happen. I'm a big fan of using creme fraiche as a base. Very French.
Can I just stop you for 1 second?
Sure.
When I asked you, do you live in this world, I wasn't being malicious.
I know.
Some people just don't live in baba ganoush land or hummus.
Right.
They just don't. It's just not in their world. I think of you as being much more of like a plated appetizer or more fancy appetizer.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I would be still maybe putting it on an individual plate, like especially if it was right now during COVID time. I put all my crudité on a platter, or I put them individually plated on 6 small plates.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Give it to everybody, and then this is your carrots, your celery, whatever you're giving away, and the dip put on the table. And I would do individual little cup dip. But to go back to the dip itself, I'm a big fan of using creme fraiche as a base for the sourness of the creme fraiche, which is what I really love so much about creme fraiche, that flavor, that tanginess, because it matches really well with, you know, especially if you're doing vegetables of crudité idea on a plate, on a platter. I think when you dip that in something that has a little sourness, it's really good. I love lemon. I love to do combinations of things. Like if you do a mayonnaise base, for example. By the way, this time of year, it's a great idea to make a nice little batch. Teach yourself how to make a homemade mayonnaise. Make a couple cups. Put half of it in the fridge and use the other one for your party. You will have a backup mayonnaise in your own refrigerator and you can use over the next week or so.
Or even, I would say, 30 days.
I mean, it keeps well. If you keep it refrigerated, it keeps well.
Yeah.
So... You know, I would keep that. And then the cool thing about mayonnaise base homemade is you can add like a puree of chili pepper, for example. There are on the market, there's harissa, there's different things. You can add that to your mayonnaise as needed. You know, so if, for example, if you're doing an order of tray of vegetable, for example, just to start, you can have different dipping sauce made with mayonnaise base. So one could be just... lots of fresh chive and tarragon put into the mayonnaise with a dash of white wine vinegar. So now you've perked up that mayonnaise into something a little bit more fresh, herby, and tangy with the vinegar. You can have it with harissa, like I was saying. So you have a spicy one. You can do a red wine reduction with some fried shallots and then put that into your mayonnaise, and that will give it that very, very deep, rich, kind of a meaty flavor. You know, and so there's all kind of different ways to use it as a base. And the same thing with the creme fraiche. The creme fraiche is already a tangy, sour kind of flavor. And then from that, you can add all kind of different things into it. Fresh herbs is always a good idea because it enhances the flavor right away. And of course, there's a liquid dipping sauce, which to me is the basis of a basic vinaigrette. You know, vinegar, 1 part, oil, 3 part.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic of any kind of, you know, vinaigrette that in the classic French dish. So you take that, and then from that you can add fish sauce, you can add all kind of different things, which totally changes the profile and enhance the flavor. And it makes for great dipping sauce. But it's also a great way to go into your cupboard and get rid of those bottles you've been looking at and not using, or that are not going fast, the one in your refrigerator that have been standing. It's a good time to use all those products and make dipping sauces.
I have two dips that I love to serve. One is baba ganoush.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
I have to have mine super charred. I like that smokiness when you get it over the charcoal grill and burn that skin and then take the skin off, right? I love that smoky flavor. There's a company called Dreamland that's up. I want to say 120th and Aurora. You can find their baba ganoush in places like Shoreline Central Market, Ballard Market. I'm not sure if Met has them or not, but... They're in a lot of the groceries, so I would look for Dreamland baba ganoush, or make your own. And if you don't want to start to grill, just put it right over your open burner fire on your stove or under the broiler in your oven and just burn the heck out of it. Turn your fan on. The other one I like is baña calda.
Oh.
And I just think that it's one of those things that you can own yourself because the herb mixture. So baña calda is basically a hot vat of or a bath of anchovies and parsley and herbs and garlic and
lemon.
Olive oil and lemon. And, you know, at the Palace Kitchen, I serve a goat cheese fondue and have for 26 years. And I serve in these little individual pots. And these are stainless little cups, or maybe a couple ounces. And they sit over top of a tea candle. And so I, from an individual perspective, you can probably get these online for $4 or $5 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
They're fun to have around.
Right.
They're good for cheese fondue. They're good for bagna calda. They're good for a lot of things, especially when you're trying to go individual portions.
Right.
And so I think that's something I would take a look at. Matter of fact, you can find them at many restaurant supply houses that are open to the public, like Seattle Restaurant Supply, Bar Green Restaurant Supply, Place Dick's might have those things also. So good fun things to serve during the holidays that you can make individually and serve just like a little, like you said, a little plate of array of fresh shucked vegetables. All right, we're going to ask the meat man a real question, right? When you go to the market, be
what
smart with your questions. Well, I mean, there's everything from prime or choice. There's a lot of questions. We're going to do that when we come back on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's time for Ask the Meat Man. So we sent out a post to our Facebook. Let's do that again. Madeline sent a post to Facebook for our listeners to send in their meat counter questions. A lot of people buy meat this time of year. So we can answer those, plus tips and tricks for any trip to the butcher and what to ask for, the best proportion, how to save money, all that sort of thing. So Gail Schreibers, she says, a recipe I saw in the New York Times for Simmies, T-S-I-M-M-I-E-S, calls for bone-in flanken or English-cut pork ribs. Do butchers ever cut ribs this way for the refrigerated meat case? And or would they be a special order? So the trick, the one that got me was the bone-in pork ribs, right? So usually flanken ribs, you see, are short ribs, beef short ribs.
Right.
So, yeah, I would tell the butcher personally that, see the way that short rib is cut over there? That's what I want out of a pork rib. And basically, if you can't find it, I would use the St. Louis cut on back ribs, on spare ribs.
So what's the St. Louis cut?
A regular rack of spare ribs, you see the whole rack of bones, and then there's that little flap, or what they call the tips.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That is cut off of a St. Louis, and it's basically one long rectangle.
Okay.
Without any of that lower trim,
That
flap meat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if I would substitute that for the flanken pork ribs.
Okay, that sounds delicious. One of my favorite piece of beef to cut from or to cook from is the plate.
Yeah.
With the plate, which is basically located in the belly, you know, right next to the...
On the breast, right?
On the breast, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a beautiful piece of meat.
25% fat, which is why it's so delicious.
which is why I like it so much. It's a good place to start when you want to braise something. It's really good.
All right, Barbara Haas, she wants to know, will your butcher spatchcock a chicken or turkey for you?
Yes, otherwise he's not your butcher.
Otherwise, find a new butcher, exactly. So spatchcocking is literally just taking the backbone out, right?
Yeah.
And so here's why the butcher might do that for you, and I have no problem with this. The butcher will weigh your chicken or will weigh your turkey as whole.
Whole.
And then they'll take the bone out. Now, if you don't take that bone with you, they'll sell that as bone for a couple of bucks a pound.
Yeah.
So it's in their best interest. If you take it with you, then it's just a service that they're offering.
Right.
But like if you go to a fish shop like Mutual Fish, you say, will you take that fish off the bone, that whole fish, will you fillet my carp for me or my snapper, or will you clean the crab? Yeah, they'll do that, of course. And that's what good butcher shops and fish markets do.
Exactly.
Yeah. So next question.
By the way, it's also a good training, Tom, if you buy a whole chicken, this is for you to train at home. I mean, the worst that's going to happen is you're going to leave a little
cut
meat.
Cut your hand off.
Meat.
That's the worst that's going to happen. Well, when you're going through a backbone with maybe a dull knife, you got to be very careful.
Let's start from the beginning. Sharp knife
or
good chicken.
Or good butcher scissors.
Yeah, good butcher. Yeah. Actually, yeah, good scissors would be good.
Martha Stewart uses scissors all the time. Kath Deedon says, or asked, many recipes call for a 3-pound chicken. Where do you get 3-pound chickens? The ones I see are almost always between 4 and 5 pounds. Wow. Well, that's a big chicken, 4 to 5 pounds.
Yeah, 3-pound chicken do exist.
Yeah. And so I would just ask the butcher, you know, even at the grocery store.
Yeah.
I was just at Shoreline, and they had these special Mount Vernon, I want to call them red something chickens, and they were all 2.5 to 3.5 pounds. And you just have to ask.
5 pound is definitely an organic, walk around the farm for a while, look good.
And then if you go to a farmer's market and buy chicken from one of those purveyors, you know, it's not like at Draper Valley, right, where all the chickens come down the line and they're sorted. And at a farmer's market, they probably have a 4 pound chicken, a 2 pound chicken. They're harvesting their own.
Mother Nature does not make it even like that.
Yeah, exactly. So I would check out any of those folks. And if you don't see what you want, ask, right?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. Always ask. Make your friend, make your butcher your best friend.
Because mm-hmm.
next time he sees you, you're going to go, oh, that's right. Hey, we got some new ribs in, whatever. He's gonna give you what's going on in the butcher shop mm-hmm. in the back, which you might not even know, you know, in the front. So, oh, I got a couple beef tongues. No, he knows you like beef tongues. He's going to tell you he's got beef tongues. They're not in the front case, but they're in the back.
Yeah.
You know, and so those are good things to play with. But it doesn't hurt to be friend with a butcher, a fishmonger, a wine guy. Those are good friends to have.
Here's the other thing I will say is your butcher buys meat just like you buy meat.
Correct.
They just buy it from a different source, right? They're buying wholesale.
And bigger pieces probably.
Generally,
generally.
And so if you were to say, I want tomahawk steaks, mm-hmm. but your butcher doesn't carry tomahawk steaks, don't go there and just say, do you have a tomahawk steak, and then be disappointed.
Right.
If you know, like I know right now I'm doing a class on tomahawk steaks later in this month, I'm ordering that beef now.
Right.
All that beef comes in what we call cryovac, like almost an airtight plastic sealed bag.
Mm-hmm.
That meat could sit in my fridge for months.
Probably weeks for sure.
Weeks for sure. 3 weeks minimum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now's the time to order that.
Correct.
And then you'll have what you want on that week before Christmas or whatever holiday you're celebrating. Just now's the time. Now you've got it. So do give a heads up. Like if you want to have veal osobuco, that's a great all-day project. Right?
Yeah.
There's not a place, a lot of places, let's say you're making for six. Not a lot of places have either
veal shank.
Six large veal shank slices or 12 small veal shank slices because you'll need two small ones or one large one.
That's why you need a butcher as your friend. You pre-order it, and then you get it a week early, and then...
Or if you see it now, but you don't want it for 2 weeks... Your butcher probably has a cryovac machine that they can just say, you know, I'd really like those oxtails now. I know they're going to be sold out over the holiday. Can you cryovac those for me? And he'll do it.
Yeah.
They have those machines.
Of course.
Yeah. So to me, it's a conversation.
Right.
It's all about the same thing you would have a conversation with the wine guy. And you'd say, you don't just walk in and say, if you have a consistent wine person like Mike Tier down in Pike Western, I would go in and say, Mike, this is what I'm serving for Thanksgiving. What should I be looking for?
Right.
And the same thing we just talked about your butcher, where you say, what do you have that's fabulous right now?
And also, your butcher will teach you about the different parts of the beef mm-hmm. for the different purposes. You know, if you say I'm making a braise, a bœuf bourguignon, he's not going to recommend filet bœuf. He's going to recommend... You know, he's not going to say, I have a piece of filet.
Well, if he recommends filet, then you've got the wrong butcher.
Yeah. You need to change butcher.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. He's going to recommend something else. And if he doesn't know what the dish is, just tell him, explain to him what the dish is and, you know, what you're going to do with it. Are you going to cook slow and long? Or are you going to cook fast on the grill? Or are you going to, you know, those are different. That's how you select your piece of meat. And he's going to teach you as well over time. You're going to learn what place in the beef mm-hmm. those pieces come from.
Let's say you want to make veal paprikash, and you go to the butcher, and he's all out of veal, right? His veal top round that he's cut for scallopini or this or that is gone, but you have your heart set on making veal paprikash. You have to kind of, in my mind, I wouldn't go to beef there.
I would go to pork.
I would go to pork or chicken.
Yeah, I would go to pork or chicken.
And you'll end up very similarly.
Right.
Same say, maybe you want to make veal schnitzel. I had schnitzel for dinner last night, first time in a long time, but it was pork schnitzel because I couldn't get veal at the shop that I had. So I made pork schnitzel. Once you get all the breading and the mustard and all the things, I put a little arugula salad on top. It's hard to tell the difference between veal and pork, don't you think?
Today or 2 days, yes, absolutely.
Totally. So yeah. Be a little bit flexible. Your butcher will appreciate that. Support them more than just one time a year, and you'll get better service.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So, up next, it's Danielle Alvarez. We're going to try calling Australia and get a hold of her because she wrote a book called Always Add Lemon. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. All right, we're back in the Hot Stove Society kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in hat.
Terry, we have gone down under because I'm sick of this cold, rainy weather here. And I hear it's summer in the south, somewhere in the south.
And it's COVID-free.
And it's COVID-free. We've got Danielle Alvarez on the line. She's the author of Always Add Lemon. And when I think about that, I think it's a great lesson. You know, I think about my professional kitchens. It's a great lesson for cooks who are always adding salt to kind of back off and add some lemon and brighten things up with lemon. So let's find out why Danielle named her book that, why she loves lemon so much, and what she has to offer here for your holiday seasonal cooking. Hi, Danielle.
Hello.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. Where are you in Australia?
So I'm in Sydney.
Cool.
Lovely, and I'm sure the weather is going to be lovely today, as it is in Sydney every day.
Oh, yeah, it's nice. And, yes, the COVID-free part is pretty good. It's a good country to be in at the moment.
Yeah. So what do you mean when you say your cookbook title, Always Add Lemon? People, I think, don't use lemon enough. You obviously feel the same. And what does it bring to the table?
So I think, as you alluded to, a lot of people tend to just throw salt at something if they think it's not delivering the flavor that they want, or maybe they don't even know. But I think a little bit of lemon juice or some fresh acidity at the end, it could be lime, it could be vinegar or something. That tends to be the kind of flavor that I really appreciate because it just wakes things up. If you have something rich or fatty, a little bit of acidity can cut through all that and make it taste a little bit lighter. So that's the title of the book. And not every recipe has lemon in it, but it's just one of my like tricks to achieve a better flavor in the dish.
What's your background in cooking, Danielle?
I grew up in Miami, Florida, a big Cuban family. So I think the love of food started there, cooking with my mom and my grandmother, who were amazing cooks. But I enrolled in culinary school and moved to California. And I started off, my first restaurant job was at French Laundry as an intern. And from there, I just worked around the Bay Area. And finally, my last 4 years in California, I spent at Chez Panisse in Berkeley.
Wow, you've certainly started at the top and moved to the top.
I know. It really was a very shocking entry into hospitality, but it was excellent. I wouldn't trade it.
And how'd you end up in Australia? Are you just on book tour? Are you visiting? Do you live there? What's going on?
No. So I actually, so all my family's still in Miami. I was at a moment in my life where I didn't really know what to do, but I was ready for a change, to move. And I came here for a vacation and I kind of fell in love with the city, but I had no idea. I didn't really know anyone here. I had a couple friends and not in the restaurant industry. And it was a friend of mine who's an Australian guy that I worked with at Chez Panisse who somehow was contacted by a restaurant group here. And they wanted to open a venue that was similar in style or at least philosophy to Chez Panisse. So he asked me if I'd be interested and they flew me out and I got the job and moved out here 6 years ago.
Good for you. You couldn't find a spot further from Miami than Sydney.
I know. It is literally the other side of the world. Yeah.
So in your book, Always Add Lemon, you have some kind of delicious kitchen rules that you like to live by. Can you give us some hints on what they are?
So I have a few things. I mean, I try not to call them too much of rules, but number one, first and foremost, is cooking seasonally. And I think, you know, you guys understand this probably better than I do even, but it really makes food taste so much better just by choosing to cook for what is growing or what is intended to grow at the time of year that you're cooking. Secondly, I talk a lot about this. It underpins all of my philosophy, but supporting your local farmers supports your local community, and that is really important, I think, for creating better societies, and the food will always taste better, and the local farmers are the people taking care of the soil. So with that one act alone, you're doing a lot of things.
And inevitably, when you buy from a local farmer, you learn their story, too. Your food, your dinner comes with a real story.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it'll be a more thoughtful meal, for sure. If you've gone that way to try and find produce from your local farm, it will taste better, and it'll be a better meal. I'm certain of it. I say keep your favorite wooden spoon and keep it. I always, in every kitchen that I have my favorite wooden spoon with me. And I don't know why, it's because I really associate my cooking or my feel when I'm cooking like my grandmother. And she always had a wooden spoon in her hand. And I just like the feel of it. So everyone should have their own favorite one.
Love that.
And then, yeah, taste at every step of the way. So this is a big one for me. Don't just taste things at the end. Taste them kind of throughout the cooking process if you can, and definitely add seasoning as you go. Lastly, a little bit of lemon will change everything, and I think we already talked about that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's just bright, it's cheery. How do you feel? You know, one of the things I always tell my classes here at the Hot Stove is, if you're going to use a lemon, use both parts of the lemon, right? Use the zest and use the juice.
Oh, yeah.
No matter what it's calling for. Although the zest, you can't use as much maybe as the juice, because it will dominate.
But you know what I do in that case is, like, if I don't need enough lemon zest, or, you know, if the lemon is going to obviously give me too much zest to overpower it, as you say, I'll zest it into a little bit of olive oil, and I'll just kind of keep a lemon olive oil sort of at the ready, so that I can finish things with that. And it's really nice.
Yeah.
Oh, you can put it in sugar and have a lemon sugar.
There you go. Yeah.
Another question. Your book often talks about projects. Tell me about some of the projects in your book, because in this day up here where people are still in quarantine and isolating, and I know my wife has just fallen in love with her sourdough starter and is doing that as a project every day, adding, you know, rye flour or tempeh flour or, that doesn't sound like the right word. What's
bread flour.
Yeah, but there's the injera flour. What's the name of that? And anyway, she's fallen in love with that project. Tell me about some projects in your book.
Yeah, so this is the section in the back of the book that is more for, you know, people like your wife that really want to go a little bit deeper in with the home cooking. And it allows you to make at home a lot of the things that you would normally just buy at the grocery store. So in the bread section, I give you a few simple breads, not sourdough breads, but potato rolls and focaccia and fougas, which is a beautiful leaf-shaped French loaf type of bread, that are quite simple that I think you would enjoy making. In the dairy section, I teach you how to make yogurt and ricotta and creme fraiche, which I think are some basic staples of dairy that are quite simple to make at home.
That's right.
Deliver so much in terms of flavor if you're able to get really nice milk. And then in the meat section, I give you a good formula for making your own sausage meat, which I love to make for making pastas, etc. And then a really gorgeous terrine and chicken liver parfait, which are a little bit more advanced, but I think if you're wanting to take that step, the recipes are really good. And then in terms of pickles, I give you a few quick pickle ideas, because sometimes you can't get through all those vegetables, and it's nice to have something, especially in winter months, that you can dig out of the cupboard or the fridge to brighten things up. Again, it's that returning to acidity that I love. So I always have pickles around to throw into things.
I say that all the time as well, that acidity at the end of making a sauce, a stock, a soup, a stew. I mean, to me, I'm 100% with you on this. It's the final of the it's the kick in the pants on the dish. I mean, I think it's really delicious.
Like, I mean,
fresh herb and lemon or fresh herb and vinegar at the end of a dish is definitely the fireworks.
Yeah, like I have a recipe for celery root soup. Mm-hmm. With roots and some artichokes, and as part of the recipe, you add in just like a teaspoon of vinegar, so really not much at all at the end, and you wouldn't believe the difference in when you taste it before to when you taste it after. It's like night and day.
Awesome. Well, Danielle Alvarez is the author. Always Add Lemon is the book. Sounds like a great adventure for the holiday season when you're stuck at home cooking dinner every night. Why not try this book and have a good time?
And when I'm coming to Sydney, I'm definitely going to eat at Fred's.
Please, please do.
All right. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you, guys.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Poor thing. We woke her up at 5 o'clock in the morning to chat with her. We
okay.
appreciate her dedication to the book. When we come back, it's time for Black Friday deals. All this weekend, there's so much going on out there. I have one item that I want to buy. It's not necessarily a deal, but I want to buy it on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society. It's time for Black Friday deals.
Wow.
I know it's Saturday and Sunday night here on our show, but there's still time to get in, I'm sure. Speaking of Black Friday deals, Chef.
Yes.
We have a little Rub with Love action going on at the dock over the weekend. Buy any three rubs and get a free jar of toasted shallot mustard for a savings of $6.50. Buy any four rubs and get a free jar of ginger pineapple teriyaki sauce for a savings of $7.50. Purchase $75 worth of rubs or sauces and receive a free I Love Crab Cakes cookbook, a $20 value. Woohoo!
Nice.
Well, we got it going on for Black Friday and weekend. And purchase $100 worth of rubs and sauces and receive a free Dahlia Bakery cookbook, $35 value.
That's so awesome.
Man. 16-ounce salmon pork steak, regular price, $18.99. Black Friday deal, $14.99.
Wow.
I feel like I'm at the Puyallup Fair right now.
I know.
And... buy a jar of salmon or steak rub and get a free grilling plank while supplies last. So we got so much going on. We got the wine. We've got the rub stuff.
You got a whole market set up on
the
dock.
I've never done a Black Friday sale before. By the way, I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
A couple of weeks ago on the show, we had a woman, Sam, I think her name was, the king barista of the world. She won the world championships a few years ago or last year. I can't remember. But... she inspired me to start looking at Burr coffee grinders. Now, I make coffee every morning. When I get up, I turn the pot of water on and I grind my coffee in my little Krups coffee grinder, which doubles as my spice grinder when I need it. And
little cumin inside your coffee.
A little cumin coffee, yeah. The one time it tastes like cumin, I mean, I just don't use it very often. Other than that, and to have multiple grinders around doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Or I use my mortar and pestle, but whatever. The point being is that she inspired me. She said on this show that a Burr coffee grinder was the way to go and that it'll change your life when it comes to your coffee. So I've been kind of in the back of my head. You know, I'm a shopper. If there's a new tool, I'll try it. So I've been kind of looking at them.
I can't wait because I thought that was a very cool idea she gave us.
Well, we'll see.
But, I mean, I can't wait to see what you're going to say.
Yeah. So, anyway, so I was looking at them on Amazon this morning when I was awake at 5 o'clock this morning. And there's so many. Here's something I didn't even – I mean, I know that we use these in the restaurants. They're big. They're expensive. They're $1,000. I mean, blah, blah, blah. I didn't realize there were $49 home versions of these. Yeah. $49. So I was looking at them, and I used the Amazon site because – I don't always buy there, but I often do. But I love their comparisons that you can do on ratings. And when you look at the ratings on Amazon for, like, this grinder to that grinder, you've got, like, some of them have 3,000 responses. You get a real cross-section of ratings rather than, wow, it's got 5 stars, but there's only 1 review.
And it's the guy who sells it.
I know. So, anyway, I've been looking at these Burr, B-U-R-R, coffee grinders, and there's difference between conical – so down the
correct
top to bottom tube shape, or other versions that aren't conical, you know. But I couldn't pull the trigger. There are so many, and they range. The ones that I was looking at, the top rated one was OXO, which is the grip kitchen equipment, right?
Yeah.
So my tendency is to want to go there, but it was kind of plasticky, and then, you know, it had a stainless steel cup, and I couldn't see the amount of coffee. I had to open it up to kind of see the amount of coffee. But the other ones are all plastic-based, and so I couldn't make a decision this morning. But that is going to be my Black Friday shopping.
Wow. I can't wait to hear if it's actually useful or not or all that stuff.
If there was a Black Friday deal on a KitchenAid mixer, you don't own one of those. Right.
You know what? I would definitely.
You said your wife still has the hand one that she uses. Yeah.
Correct.
I'm telling you.
If I have two in my restaurants. I mean, if I need one, I can just bring one home.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
No.
But
yes,
but if there was a good deal. If you're buying a KitchenAid mixer, it's like, you know, out there, lots of people have deals. I would buy personally the 5-quart bowl. There's two sizes, right? There's like the 3.5-quart bowl, and then the head pops back on it when you want to get into the bowl.
Right.
Or there's the ones we use here at the hot stove or in the kitchens that have the lever that raises and lowers the bowl.
Correct.
That is the one I would go with. And they have a 5 or a, I believe they even have a 6-quart bowl now.
Right.
I would go the bigger, the better.
Right.
Because you're, what you get generally when you get the bigger one is you get a bigger motor.
Correct.
And when you use your KitchenAid mixer to power things like your pasta machine or your we were just grinding our wheat berries, our rye berries for Jackie's sourdough.
Oh, yeah, grains.
Right, because all the rye flour was sold out, but I could get rye berries, and so we just ground our own flour.
Right.
The sausage stuffing attachment, the more power, the better.
Yeah.
On that. So that's I think that KitchenAid mixer, if you can find that on sale, that would be something that...
That is a good... That is.
Think about it this way, right? Think about it as a lifetime purchase.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You know, it's $300 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
If it's for a lifetime. You're not buying three of them during your lifetime, mm-hmm. hopefully. I mean, how you have an insurance on it and everything. I mean, you're not buying five in a lifetime.
Right.
So just look at it as you're buying it as a tool that you're going to have forever.
Right. If it lasts 20 years, it's $15 a year.
Same with...
If it lasts 30 years, it's $10 a year.
Same with pots and pan of high value. Thick bottom, stainless steel inside. You know, maybe aluminum outside, that's fine, but stainless steel inside. Those are expensive pots. I mean, they're $250 or whatever, $200. But you're only buying one for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I have saute pan in my restaurant that I use every day. They're 12-inch saute pan. Those came with Rovers 32 years ago. I'm still using them every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're dark on the outside. They get a little carbon burn on the outside. But the inside is stainless steel. Very, very... They get super, super hot. Mm-hmm. You put them on the cold water. You rinse them off with a steel pad. Boom, done.
So I think that goes in the category of, yeah, it's a hot buy. It's 50% off. But if it's a crappy pan, it's a crappy pan.
Yeah, I mean.
So it's not really a hot buy.
No.
It just means that next year you'll be looking again for a hot buy, right?
Correct. Same with.
So I disagree with that premise a little bit on knives, for example.
Right.
There's a lot of knives out there. You can buy a chef knife for $20, $25. You can buy a chef knife for $120, $250, $450.
Correct.
I prefer the cheap chef knife. Because I'm not the best knife sharpener, and as soon as you just start to create a little bit of a moon shape in that knife, it's useless when you're trying to chop, and so it gets thrown away. And so I'd much rather buy a knife every couple of years for $25 or $35 than buy a $150 knife every couple of years, personally.
Yeah,
so that's just my nature.
It depends on what, knives can get very addictive in terms of, I mean, I have some knives. I bought a knife in Australia last time I was in Australia at a market, custom made, and that was a $250 knife. That was not a cheap knife.
If there was one thing,
but
like I said, I'm going to buy this Burr coffee grinder in the next week or so after I do my research. What's one kitchen tool that you'll buy this holiday season or that you would like to buy other than a new stove?
No, I think, No, I don't need to change my 62 Roper.
Yeah.
What is wrong with you? I probably would go with a KitchenAid.
A mixer.
Because, because I think it's, it's not just a mixer. It's a mixer, it's a grinder, it's a sausage stuffer, it's a pasta. I have the pasta attachment already, all those different things. It's a very useful tool, you know, especially if you cook a lot at home.
Yeah.
It's very useful. And if you entertain, it's a must because once you start making dough, I told you, my wife used it the other day for the first time she made dough. She never makes pie, never makes tart because she does not like to make dough because it's painful, whatever. She used the KitchenAid and she went,
oh. She used the KitchenAid or the Cuisinart? I mean, food processor.
No, no, the KitchenAid. And she was like, oh, my God.
Nice.
Nice difference. She goes, I could make pie all the time. I'm like, uh-oh.
All right. One of my favorite gifts to give during the holidays is a case of wine. This season, I'll be curating my holiday case with a variety of my favorite wines from around the world. We're kicking off Black Friday with a case of white, a case of red, or a mixed case. They're around $150, so about, $12.50, $13 a bottle. with a value guaranteed over $200 a bottle. So that's for the entire month of December. Well, come do your Christmas shopping with us. If you want to be part of the show, you can join our community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio. The show is produced by our team, Madeline Pennington and Amy Richardson. Sound and production by Sean McFadden. And editor is Sean, don't call me Del Torre. Remember, if you miss any episode of Hot Stove, on Cairo, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening and have a fabulous weekend.